Thank you for saying that it's daunting. So one of the things that I will do as we do this is to explain to you what is happening here, what is going on with the sutras, and this is the word of the Buddha. And sometimes the translations you find into English can be sometimes very hard to understand, and especially English is your second language, right? Makes it all the more difficult to understand what's going on there. So one of the things that I will do is try to explain to you in detail what is going on there. And if you still don't understand, then that's an opportunity and a chance to raise your hand and we'll get some more details out of this there. So the very first sutta that we have here today is the sutta I like to read out of every time I do this kind of sutta, because I think it is very powerful and very important sutta in many ways. And it is really about the process of meditation. That is what the sutta is about. And you can call it, if you like, you can call it the psychology of meditation if you want. This is how you are supposed to experience meditation. Ideally, right, the reality is, of course, it's never quite 100% like this, but this is the ideal way that meditation is supposed to be experienced. So this is why this is very, very useful. Now, the first thing perhaps I should explain, how do we decide that a particular sutta is important or not? Right? This is an important question. How do we know? And sometimes you will hear people say, oh, this sutta is so important. Satipatthana Sutta, the essence of Buddhist meditation practice, right? Or somebody has another favorite sutta, Pranapanasati Sutta, whatever. This is the essence of Buddhist meditation practice. So, but is there a more scientific way? Is there a more kind of objective way of deciding these things? So, if we ask, but why is the Satipatthana Sutta the most important one? Is there any reason for believing that? And if the Buddha doesn't say anywhere that the Satipatthana Sutta is the most important, so because the Buddha doesn't say that, we have, you know, okay, it is obviously important, every sutta is important, but it's not, doesn't really stand out in any particular way. So the way to decide whether something is important is those teachings that you find again and again in the suttas, right? You find the Buddha saying to these people, he says to the monks, to the nuns, to the lay people in different locations with slight variations each time he teaches it. This is one of those very powerful things about the Buddha. It also makes the sutta very boring, right? But one of the powerful things about the Buddha is that he can give the same teaching with a slight variation. And you think it, sometimes you think it's boring, but actually, when you look at it carefully, it actually enriches the sutta so enormously. Because when you get a slightly different angle, it's as if you're seeing it in a new way. And when you see it in a new way, you get a more complete understanding of that particular sutta. So never think it is boring. Okay, if you think it's boring, of course, you have to be honest to yourself, and it's fair enough. But try to kind of see the positive side of this, these repetitions and these things. Because once you do that, it will enhance the joy and the happiness you get from reading these sutras. So this particular sutra here is one of these sutras. It's called volition, which means like the will, right, the doer inside. This is one of those sutras that you find in so many different places. The basic structure is also the same as the Bhujangas, the practice of awakening. It's one of the very important core teachings of Buddhism. If you go to the Agamas, everybody know what the Agamas are now? Anybody does not know what the Agamas are now? One, two, okay. Quite a few don't know anything about the Agamas. Okay, so I'll give you a very quick explanation of the Agamas. The Agamas are basically the same as these sutras here, but they were transmitted in the Chinese language instead. Right? So the Agamas, you find them in Chinese. It is a very ancient, old Chinese, the Chinese spoke about 1,500 years ago, so you probably find it quite difficult to read as straight as it is. But basically, that's what the Agamas are, the Chinese translation of these things. Actually, that's not quite right. The Agamas are really the original sutra that came out of India and then were transmitted to China. But that, it doesn't really matter here. And what is fascinating about this, and that's just to give you a little bit of background for those of you who haven't heard this before, and this is, I think, very fascinating and very interesting, and it's a very powerful indication that the sutras that we have now actually are the word of the Buddha. Right? I mean, it's a good question. Is this really the word of the Buddha? People say this is the word of the Buddha. But how do they know that? Yeah, it's passed down for 2,500 years, but surely there has been corruptions, right? But surely somebody has memorized it wrongly, somebody has written down the wrong thing, but thought it was one when it was something else. How do we know that we still have the word of the Buddha? And one of the powerful ways of knowing that is to look at the different lineages, the way that Buddhism has been passed down over the centuries, over the millennia. And these lineages that we talk about, these different schools of Buddhism, they started spreading out around the time of Ashoka. Emperor Ashoka, the most famous king in Indian history, including queens as well. I'm not sure if there were that many queens in India. It was a very kind of male-oriented society. But anyway, the most powerful monarch in Indian history, he ruled over what is all of India today, plus even more than that. So very, very powerful. And he lived in the 3rd century BC, so about 2,300 years ago. And during his time, that's when Buddhism started to spread out. Because he sent missionaries around India to spread the word of the Buddha. One of the missionaries he sent out was to the north of India, and that became known as the Sarvastivadin school of Buddhism. Don't worry so much about the names of the schools. Sarvastivadin means all exist school. It's basically based on the philosophy that was prevalent in that school later on. So they went to the north of India, right? Now he sent another missionary to Sri Lanka. Sri Lanka is, of course, today one of the strongholds of Theravada Buddhism. That was Mahinda. He was a son of King Ashoka, and he established Buddhism in Sri Lanka. That became the Theravada school of Buddhism that we have today. Right? So 2,300 years ago, one school went to the north of India, another went to Sri Lanka. Now the distance between the north of India and Sri Lanka is enormous, about 3,000 kilometers, right? So how far is it from KL to Singapore? 300 kilometers? Yeah, so 10 times the distance from KL to Singapore. Right? It's a very, very big distance. So it's almost like, you know, the whole breadth of Australia or the kind of height of China or something like that. It's a long, long way. Right? So these schools were very separate, and they transmitted Buddhism in their own way, right, according to their own school. Completely independently of each other. The Sarvastivadin school eventually went into China. It followed the Silk Road, right? This was in north of India, following the Silk Road along with the merchants and traveling into China and translated into Chinese, ancient Chinese. And that those suttas that have been transmitted in ancient Chinese, they are called the Agamas. And then you have the Pali Sutta. Well, this is actually English, of course, but you have the this comes from the Pali. And you take the Pali and you take the Agamas and you compare them to each other, right? They have been separated, remember this, separated for 2,300 years, right? So very, very long time. And what you find, and this is kind of the really astonishing and the eye-opening thing, is that the suttas, not everything, but the core teachings of the Buddha are virtually identical in the Chinese Agamas as they are in the Pali canon. Right after 2,300 years separation. And what that gives you, it gives you this feeling that, well, if the Sangha, if the monastics have been able to preserve the teachings so well for 2,300 years, they obviously done a very good job. And it means that what we have now is basically, must be the word of the Buddha. It's only 150 years before that, and you're back to the time of the Buddha, right? So basically, you can be very, almost absolutely certain, I would say, that the essential core teachings of Buddhism must be the word of the Buddha. And this particular sutta here, this sutta called Will or Volition, is a case in point, because this one actually occurs in the Agamas as well. There are English translations now of these Agamas. So I have actually personally compared this sutta to the Chinese, the translation into English from the Chinese. And when you compare them, it is almost exactly word for word the same, right? It kind of gives you goosebumps, because what it tells you, now I'm in the presence of the Buddha. This is the Buddha teaching to me. That is what you feel when you see that, because it is so well preserved. So this is one way of deciding how important the sutta is, understanding that it has been very well preserved, and also understanding that it is a core teaching, and to see again and again in the suttas. So, for this reason, this is one of the reasons why I like this so much, and also because it is really about meditation practice. So let me read this out to you, and then I will comment on it afterwards, because it may not be very obvious what's going on here. Because for a virtuous person, one whose behavior is virtuous, no volition need be exerted. Let non-regret arise in me. It is natural that non-regret arises in one who is virtuous, one whose behavior is virtuous. One without regret, no volition need be exerted. Let joy arise in me. It is natural that joy arises in one without regret. For one who is joyful, no volition need be exerted. Let rapture arise in me. It is natural that rapture arises in one who is joyful. For one with a rapturous mind, no volition need be exerted. Let my body become tranquil. It is natural that the body of one with a rapturous mind is tranquil. For one tranquil in body, no volition need be exerted. Let me feel pleasure. It is natural that one tranquil in body feels pleasure. For one feeling pleasure, no volition need be exerted. Let my mind be stilled, concentrated. It is natural that the mind of one feeling pleasure is stilled. For one who is stilled, no volition need be exerted. Let me know and see things as they really are. It is natural that one who is concentrated knows and sees things as they really are. So what do you think? Good. Is it boring? Well, it's very repetitive, isn't it? Yes? Yes. Okay.
My English is not that good.
Yes?
So what is the meaning of volition?
Okay, I will get to that now, coming up now, right? I'm just kind of getting ready to talk about that, and I'll talk about it in 1 second. Sure. And sometimes when I ask people what they think about it, they say, oh, it's so boring, it's just one thing after the other, right? This is why I don't like reading the suttas, because it is so boring here. But actually, the point here is that when you understand the pattern of this, one thing moving to the other one, what you focus on as you move from one paragraph to the next one, you focus on that change, right? One term is changing each time. It means you get a little bit of clarity about the process, because it's very simple and easy to follow only one little change each time. So actually it's very powerful. And one of the things that you need to know about the teachings of the Buddha said that his teaching is sa'attam, sa'yamjanaya. And sa'attam means that it has a goal and a purpose, and that of course is nirvana, is the creating of happiness, the abandoning of suffering, all that. But what is also very interesting is this idea that the Buddha's teaching is sa'yamjanaya. Yamjana means expression, it means the words. So it means it has the right expression, or a good expression. So what that means, that when the Buddha spoke these suttas, it took a lot of effort into expressing them in a very careful way. Remember, at the time of the Buddha, everything was done orally, right? It went from one generation to the next one by oral transmission. They would just speak these things. Imagine the memory they had, right? The Buddha gives one sutta, and then people just remember it like that. You know, some of the suttas are really long, and they remember it almost by heart. It's quite astonishing. They had incredibly good memories, because they were used to using the memory in that particular way. So the Buddha knew that when he taught these suttas, they would be memorized, right? If you write something down, you can always cross it out and change it later on. But if you speak to 100 people, everybody memorized it, very difficult to change, right? Can't really change. So you have to lay it down in the right way, straight from the beginning. And I think that one of the things that Buddha did, he actually spent a bit of time thinking about what is the best way of expressing this. Because one thing is to have the insight, to have the awakening experience. Another thing is actually to express that in a language that people can understand. So the expression is very, very important. And the Buddha would have taken a lot of effort into expressing these things in the right way. And what that means is that when you read this, every word matters. every word is important. Every sentence, every paragraph, how it is all put together, everything is very significant. So it's worthwhile spending a bit of time and trying to understand what is going on here. So let us start with the very first word, right? Very first word, bhikkhus. So bhikkhus, everybody knows what bhikkhu is, huh? Yeah? Like this, right? Bhikkhu. Bhikkhu means monk, it's the ancient word for monk. And you also have bhikkhuni is the nuns, so they would wear roughly the equivalent robes in those days. So you have the nuns and the monks. So first of all, some of those people say, oh, bhikkhus, does that mean that I'm not a bhikkhu? What about me? I'm not a bhikkhu, so what about me? Right? If you are a laywoman, you have two steps removed, right? You are not ordained and you're also a woman. What does that mean? And what it means is just that when the Buddha taught, the audience would often be monks because it was closest to the monks. But not only that, but often when you have an audience, and an audience is composed of many parts, you may have bhikkhus there, maybe bhikkhunis there, maybe laymen there, maybe laywomen there, he often speaks to the people who are closest to him, which would be the monks, but everybody is included there. So you don't, it doesn't mean that you are excluded just because it has bhikkhus, it just means that is the way things were done in those days. So just keep that in mind, because otherwise you may feel that, you know, if you kind of excluded or something, which is not nice. You are included, so you feel good. Buddha has compassion for everyone. Okay. For the virtuous person, one who is whose behavior is virtuous. The Pali word for virtuous is sila. Sila? Yeah? Sila. Sila, Pali word for virtuous. And one of the things to understand about the word sila is that it doesn't just mean virtuous, as we often say virtue in the English language. It doesn't just mean that you don't do the bad things, right? The word sila in Pali means almost like your whole character, who you are as a person, your whole, all your habits, your way of thinking, who you have developed as a person is really what it means. So it refers more to character than it refers to virtue as such. It includes everything about who you are, really. This is a very important thing. I'm not sure if there is quite an equivalent word in English to the Pali word sila, so sometimes you have to explain what it means. But it's very important because it means that when we talk about sila, we mean the whole development of the personality. We don't just mean don't do this, don't do that. Sometimes we talk about the five precepts, and we call the five precepts sila, right? Well, they are sila, but they're not a full picture of sila. There's more to it than that. This is the first thing to keep in mind here. And then we have no volition need be exerted. Now, the word volition means the will, right? So it means the doer inside. Every time you lift your hand, it's the will that says, lift hand, okay, lift hand, okay, lift hand, right? This is the will. Every time you do anything, every time you speak, every time you say, every time you think anything, it is the will that lies behind that, that makes you do things. So what this is saying, no volition need be exerted. Well, actually what the Pali says, actually what it says, this cannot be done by the will. This cannot be done by volition. This is actually what the Pali is saying. Not really, no volition is needed. This cannot be done by volition. So there's, I think, an important difference there. So, this cannot be done by volition. Let non-regret arise in me. Right? Because, why can it not be done by volition? Because it is natural. It is dhammata that non-regret arises in one who has a virtuous and kind character. You don't feel bad about yourself, right? You don't regret anything. You don't have any darkness in the mind. You don't have any kind of little corners that you have to hide away inside of yourself because you feel you didn't do the right thing. You feel naturally right-minded as a consequence of this. Because according to nature, it's dhammata. Dhamma has this idea of nature, the laws of dhamma, the laws of how the world works. This is part of what dhamma is all about. So you don't need to think that. It happens as a matter of course. This is what this is saying. So if you are virtuous, you feel non-regret. So What is the meaning here of non-regret? Because sometimes you think non-regret means, oh, I shouldn't have done this, right? Or I'm very happy I didn't do that, or whatever. Yeah. But actually, non-regret is actually much more refined than that. It's a very refined and very subtle thing, what actually is meant here by the Buddha. Non-regret is whatever. The way to understand this is to understand what happens in your mind if you do something which is either not very nice or something which is very nice. This is how you understand these things. If you do an act which you feel wasn't very kind, right? Maybe you say something to somebody which wasn't really, oh, I feel like, oh, maybe I shouldn't have said that, right? Or you do something which isn't very nice. And if you feel your mind, you feel what is happening inside of you as you do that, what you will feel is that it's almost like you lose your energy inside of you. It's like your mind becomes a little bit more dark. Your mindfulness gets dimmed a little bit. Some of the perhaps natural joy you may have is diminished because you do something which isn't quite right. And even if you have a bad thought, just feel what the bad thought does to your mind. And what you find that the bad thought does to your mind, that again, it kind of dims it down a little bit, makes it a little bit more dark, makes it a little bit less happy to be inside of yourself. And this is really what is meant by regret here. It's a natural consequence, right? If you do something which isn't right, you have to have this sort of outcome afterwards. And that is very powerful, right? It's a very important thing to understand, because sometimes we think that we can get away with things. We think that we can get away with doing, cutting a few corners, not doing the right thing, doing things which aren't quite right, whether it is in our personal life or in our business life or whatever it is. We think we can get away with that. I will just forgive myself afterwards, right? We talk about forgiveness, and I'll forgive myself afterwards, and I'll be fine, no problem. It isn't as simple as that, because what the Buddha is saying here is that it is a natural consequence, and if you do something which isn't quite right, you will have to regret it afterwards, right? It's a natural consequence. It has to be that way. Why does it have to be that way? And the reason is very simple. The simple reason is that because we have a sense of self, right, we feel that we voluntarily did that action which wasn't quite right, which was a little bit unfriendly or a little bit unkind to somebody else. Because this is what the sense of self does. This is what the whole idea of a sense of self is all about. And we have to take ownership. We have to own that action that we did, at least to some extent. Yes, we can forgive, right? Yes, we can understand that we weren't fully in charge, that there were problems in life, it was difficult. We can forgive ourselves. But you can only forgive yourself so much. There's always going to have to be some residue of ownership of the actions that we do. And this is why this is so important, because what it means that there is no such thing as getting away with doing something bad. You can't get away with these things because you have to own it. And for that reason, because you own it, it will affect your mind and it will drag you down to some extent. That regret will arise inside of you and you will not be able to feel as pure and happy inside as you otherwise would. There's a very simple, natural cause and effect relationship here between how we act and what we do. So to be able to, and this is very important, and what it means is that when we start to practice the Buddha's path, it's as if we change our perspective on things. Right, normally we think, yeah, it's only about this life, so I can cut a few corners because, well, it's important in this life to kind of get going, get a good career, make money, and have a good time, and all these kind of things. But of course, once you start to pursue the Buddhist path, your perspective changes enormously. Because what it does, it actually reminds you that, first of all, it is not just about the material well-being and status of things, it's also about your mind. If you drag your mind down, if you sully your mind, then even if you are very successful in so many ways, you still haven't got the happiness inside. If you destroy your happiness inside, but you're very successful externally, it's crazy, right? It's madness. It's much more important to have a sense of happiness and contentment inside than it is to have all these external things. You see a lot of people in the world who are very successful and wealthy or whatever, still they are miserable, right? They're miserable because in their heart they are empty, they have nothing there. That is the problem with this system. That is one side of it. The other side of it is, of course, this very simple fact that once you take into account that there is more than one life, once you take into account that there are also future lives, suddenly your calculation about what is important, what really matters, right? Your investment plan, right? It changes. Right, you've got to invest carefully, invest in the wrong way, no return, and no return is very bad. So you want to have long-term return, not just short-term return. You want to make sure that you don't create a little bit of happiness in this life, then misery in the future life, that is no good also. So the whole thing changes when you start to understand this. You don't want to allow these regrets to arise in your mind. Anyway, so this is just an explanation of the very first factor here of this particular sutta. Before I explain the other factors, I want to just have a look more broadly at what the sutta is about, because there are some very important aspects of the sutta which I don't want to pass you by. I want to make sure that you see that. Now, one of the very central thing that this sutta makes very clear. First of all, I say it is about meditation practice, right? This is ideally what happens in a meditation. So one of the first of this sutta is that it is like it signposts whether your meditation is going right or not. This is the first thing that this sutta does. It kind of, if you want to travel to Penang but you head south from KL, you're not going to get to Penang, right? So you head north instead, and then eventually you get to Penang if you travel in the right way. And you follow the sign. If it says Penang this way, you follow the sign to Penang this way. And this is just like that. You see it on the signposts that tell you whether you are heading in the right direction. So this is very useful, right? Without signposts, you're not going to get there. If you head the wrong way, no good, and you're going to be in trouble as a consequence. So this is the first thing about this sutta. And the next thing, which is very important about this, is that if you look at those signposts, what they almost every one of them describes, they talk about happiness in one way or another. Right? If you look at all of those words, you know, they, as I said before, every paragraph is virtually the same, except for one word which changes in every paragraph. And if you look at that one word which changes in every paragraph, right? First of all, non-regret, joy, then rapture, right? Then tranquility, then pleasure, and then concentration, or stillness, or samadhi, is the second last one there. And if you look at those terms, you see that every one of them are about happiness in one way or another. It's all about this enjoyment, right, of the Buddhist path. This is, I think, an extraordinarily important message, because it means that Buddhist meditation, when it works in the right way, when you practice it in a way that actually functions, it should give rise to all of these kinds of happiness, the joy inside of you, the happiness, the tranquility. All of these things are essential part of Buddhist meditation practice. This is a very powerful message in so many ways. It's very powerful because it gives a very, sometimes we focus about dukkha in Buddhism, right? Oh, suffering, right? Life is so bad or whatever. But of course the point is that once you understand dukkha, you also understand the opposite. You understand where happiness lies. And here you can see this whole idea that meditation, as you're moving away from the suffering of life, giving up the things in life that are problematic, as you do that, joy and happiness arises as a consequence of it. One thing fades away, another arises instead. The Buddhist path is really a path of happiness, a path of contentment, a path of joy, a path of all of these beautiful qualities. And it's very uplifting, right? And of course, the ultimate goal of the whole Buddhist practice is to end all suffering, or as it says elsewhere, Nibbana Paramang Sukhan. Nibbana is the highest happiness. So all of this is about happiness. It's wonderful, isn't it? It's so beautiful when you think about that. Here we are, everyone in the world wants to be happy. Nobody wants to suffer. We all want to move away from problems, move towards more contentment and joy. This is what everybody in the world wants, regardless of how you look at it. And here is a teaching that teaches you exactly that.
It's an amazing thing, right? It's exactly what this is. It's the beginning of life. That's what it's all about, right? So what should we do? We should, wow, get in there and do it, right? And obviously we do it and the consequence. It's such an amazing thing. This was for me the most powerful understanding I remember. It took me a while to really understand what was going on, but when I started to understand that this is the answer to the question of what the meaning of life is, I thought, wow, how can I not be a Buddhist? It's madness not to be a Buddhist. You can't be a Buddhist, right? You found the answer to the question of the meaning of life. Whoa, that's it. And of course, once the more you understand that, the more you commit yourself to the Buddhist path, right? The more you understand, even if you don't become a monastic, at least you commit yourself more. You really want to do this, because here is where you find true meaning. So all about happiness. So remember that in your meditation practice. It has very important consequences for how you meditate. If you sit down and you feel pain everywhere, right? Are you going to find any happiness? Probably not, right? Or you're going to have dukkha all the time. So because of that, you start to understand how meditation itself should be practiced. That's why the middle way is so important. Not to torture yourself, not to create artificial pain, but to find that middle way. And that middle way, that is where this kind of happiness becomes possible. So just remembering that it's supposed to be a path of ease, a path of enjoyment, a path of happiness, just remembering that is very, very powerful. Because it gives you a guideline, it gives you a kind of a something you can follow. And you can follow that and you know that you're headed in the right direction. You can judge your practice and know whether you're doing the right thing. And this is what I find. I've been a monk now for over 20 years, right? So some people say it's a long time, some people say it's a short time, I don't know. It's quite a while, I suppose. But one of the reasons why you can be a monk for 20 years is this feeling that this is what's happening, right? Gradually, the problems are left behind. Gradually, you become more content, more happy, more kind, more compassionate, more understanding. These things grow slowly. And when you see that, you know that you are on the right path. It's very powerful to see these things actually happening inside of you. When you see that, you're heading in the right direction. And this is what I love about this sutta. It's all so clear that it's all about enjoying ourselves. And that's exactly what we want to do anyway. So it's great. Okay. And then one of the things here that is also very important is this no volition needs to be exerted, right? So no will is required. In fact, as I said, it doesn't actually mean quite that. It means that this cannot be done through willpower. It cannot be done by doing things. It cannot be done by controlling your mind, right? This is the wrong way. So every step in the sequence is like that. Cannot be done by control. Cannot be done by willpower. In fact, what it means is that the willpower gets in the way. The willpower is a problem. If you cannot get that by willpower, if you use willpower, you're doing the wrong thing. And you're not going to get the results that you otherwise would have. So everything of this is, if there is no willpower, then how does it work? So if it's God, if you think it's God, maybe controlling us, maybe moving in the right direction. Maybe, it's possible, but maybe not, right? Of course, the Buddhist idea is that there is no God. So from the Buddhist point of view, what this is about is not about God or anybody outside of us, even the Buddha or any teacher you may have or anything like that. It is because it is an automatic process that happens all by itself. This is how this works. So every step happens by itself. It's dhammata. It happens according to the laws of nature, right? Just like when you drop something, gravity, it falls down. It's a dhammata. It has to fall down. In exactly the same way, if you just sit back and you just chill and you just enjoy yourself, this happens all by itself. Right? Very, very powerful, because it means it is supposed to be so easy, so nothing to do, right? You don't have to control anything. Very, very easy, very relaxing, very enjoyable, and that's why there is so much happiness also as part of this. And then you may think, but if it is that easy, all you have to do is sit back. This is how Ajahn Brahm teaches the meditation, right? And I'm like, oh, just relax, enjoy yourself, right? And then people go around and say, well, what do you mean, just enjoy myself? I'm not enjoying myself, I'm sitting there, nothing is happening. How is it supposed to work? And
this is kind of the core question here, right? Is if this is true, and I always get very inspired when I see that Ajahn Brahm said this is exactly what the sutta says, just sit back and, you know, and don't have to do anything. Why then doesn't it work always? Why is it that we don't get those results? Why is it that you don't get happiness every time? All you have to do is sit back. You should get happiness every time, right? How come? And the reason is because what we have to do here is we have to go back to the very first factor, right? The very first factor is the one that sets this whole thing in motion. It's when the first factor is established, then this train starts to work, and one thing comes after the other one. So it is the first factor here that is the most important one. Get the first factor right, and then this whole sequence will happen as a matter of course. And what is that first factor? It is sila. Yes, exactly. So it is our character, right? It is our morality. It is our degree of kindness. It is our sympathy for the people around us. It is our mental world, right? Remember, if we're dealing with character, it is not enough just to think in terms of our actions and in terms of our speech. Even our mental world is important here. So how we think about other people, how we think about, you know, your fellow members here at the VGF. I would recommend you to have a lot of metta and kindness for your fellow members at the VGF, because it creates a strong organization, right? You feel good about each other, and also it enhances your practice so much if you do that. So this is where the problem arises. So a lot of what we have to do is to improve our character, improve who we are, and we need often to be very honest with ourselves. Where are my weaknesses? We all have weaknesses, right? Where are my weaknesses? It doesn't mean that we should just focus on weaknesses because then you get very depressed, right? You should also think, you should actually be quite happy with yourself. You know, you are here studying the Dhamma, keeping the precepts, doing meditation practice. Wow, it's all very good already. But how can we improve even more? This is what this should be about. And as you do that, as you improve even more, you find that that has a very powerful impact on your meditation practice. So this is the crucial issue here, according to the sutta, is how is our character as people. And a lot of the things I will talk about in the rest of this sutta camp is going to be about that. How to develop our minds in such a way that we are more pure as human beings. Very powerful message there, in my opinion. And another powerful message here is found at the very end of the sutta. It's not a very important one. And that is the very last one that says that for one who is concentrated, right? Please don't tell Ajahn Brahm that I use the word concentrated, because he will not be very happy. So let's change it just for the sake of respecting my teacher. For one who is stilled, no will can be exerted to let me know and see things according to reality. I think according to reality is better than things as they really are, because there aren't really any things as such, it's just things moving and changing all the time. It is natural that one who is still knows and sees things according to reality. This is a very important part, again, of the Buddhist teachings, one that is highly underestimated sometimes, I think. And this is that if you really want to have knowing and seeing things according to reality, this is what insight really is about, right? If you see things according to reality, that is exactly what insight is. So what the sutta is saying is that if you want to have real insight into things, the only way you can do that is by having stillness, by having samadhi. Stillness here is a translation for samadhi. The only way to do that is by having samadhi first, right? So it just actually says that here, the only way is to have samadhi first. This one just says that if you have samadhi, this will happen. But there are other suttas that say that if you haven't got samadhi, then the cause, heart upanisa, the cause is destroyed for seeing things as they actually are. So samadhi is the cause, right? The root condition to be able to have real insight into the Dhamma. So remember that. Very often when you hear about insight meditation, remember that that insight that you have at that level is going to be fairly shallow. It's only when you have samadhi that you can actually see things according to reality and have deep insight. So this shows you that on the Buddhist path, these things we call samadhi on the one hand, and the thing we call insight, which can often be called panya, perhaps wisdom. In this case, it's called yathabhuta nyanadarsana, and seeing things, seeing and knowing things according to reality. These things, samadhi and insight, are very, very closely connected with each other. And really, the reality is that they are two sides of the same utensil, same mind, or whatever it is. That was similarly used by Ajahn Chah. Everybody knows who Ajahn Chah is, everybody just know him. Yeah? Okay. Perhaps the most famous meditation teacher in Thailand in the 20th century, very, very famous in Thailand. And he said, insight, samadhi and wisdom are two sides of the same mind. Right? Can you have a one-sided knife? Like a Zen koan, right? One-sided knife. No. So you cannot have a one-sided knife. You have to have two sides. So two sides are the same thing. Yeah. So this is what you also see here. Yeah. So this is, I think, extremely important to remember that. And again, this is something you see going throughout the suttas. So now, before we have a short break, I just want to quickly run through all of these various factors to give you some idea what they all mean. So, from having a virtuous character or having a good character, you get non-regret. Your mind tends to be bright. You tend to be mindful. You tend to have energy. These things all go together. When you have this mindfulness and energy, you have joy. Right? If you have nothing to regret, it's weird, isn't it? The reason why we don't have joy, if you haven't got joy in your mind, it means there's some regret in there. You may not be able to see the regret, but there's something in there which is blocking the natural joy from arising. So you know that there's something which darkens your mind a little bit. That's why you haven't got that joy. The joy is called pamujja in Pali. And pamujja is like a very kind of natural gladness. I'm sure all of you here experience this sometimes. Sometimes you just feel glad, right? You feel the gladness inside. The world is easy. You kind of, you know, you're very happy and everything is very good, right? And you do something nice for somebody, you feel a sense of joy inside them. You all know that feeling, right? It's a very kind of basic joy that people feel. Sometimes people don't feel this. Sometimes people get depressed or whatever, and it's very hard to feel the joy. But most people sometimes feel joy in their mind. And then as your meditation gets deeper, that joy gets transformed into rapture. It's piti in the Pali language. Rapture is like the intensification of that joy. You can often feel it in the body, right? It's like the body gets a little electrified. That's pretty cool, isn't it? Electrified body. You feel like a kind of flowing of electricity through the body. And it can be a very, very strong feeling. You feel very, wow, this is really neat, isn't it? This kind of this feeling of having that. And then as you continue your meditation practice, that rapture starts to die down. You become tranquil. You still have joy in the mind, right? But it's a joy that is conjoined with tranquility. This is even more powerful, even more beautiful. Right? Step by step, more powerful, more beautiful. You think perhaps that just feeling joy in ordinary life is great. It is great. It is very nice to feel that already. But here, we're just going from one happiness, more profound than the other one, one after the other, right? This is what's going on here. So you feel tranquility. The joy is still there. And then, from that tranquility is like the body completely, almost like disappearing, right? Because the body is so tranquil. There's no problem in the body anymore. The mind is getting focused at this point. There's no restlessness anymore in the mind. The mind is completely focused on the nimitta, perhaps. This, you know, this bright light you're seeing in the mind or whatever it is. And because of that, from that arises an even more profound pleasure, which is sukha in Pali. And that's what we're talking about here. Sukha is the pleasure that Bhikkhu Bodhi translates here as. And then, because you have this powerful pleasure inside of you, this powerful sense of happiness, that your mind is absolutely glued on your object of meditation. At this point, you're probably seeing a very powerful nimitta. A nimitta is like this light in the mind, right? And sometimes people say it's like seeing the sun, it's so powerful. like, oh, I can't see anymore, it's just too bright, right? Just put the hand before the eye. It doesn't help because it's inside your mind, so still seeing the sun. And that was one of the, I remember there was a lady who came, and I heard a story, where did I hear a story? Maybe in Melbourne. Anyway, she was from Melbourne, and she was originally from Vietnam, this lady. And she told me this story. She must have had a very pure, very pure hearted lady. And she told me this story. She went into one of the Vietnamese monasteries in Melbourne, right? And as she went through the gate, there was this big Quan Yin statue just next to the gate, Quan Yin, the Mahayana Quan Yin, right? And because she was from that Mahayana background, she had a lot of faith in Quan Yin. So she went down, she went over to the Buddha statue. And she told me, when I went over this Buddha statue, I bowed down. As I bowed down, the sun was there. It was so bright. I couldn't see anything. It was terrible. It was so incredibly bright. I put my hands over my eyes and the sun was still there. Right? And I asked her, well, how did you feel? Oh, I felt so happy. I felt so very, very powerful happiness, right? And what she was telling me basically, she was experiencing a nimitta, right? A very powerful nimitta. Because just because of bowing down to Kuan Yin, because she had so much confidence and so much faith, just that act was enough to feel almost this whole sequence that people sometimes do in meditation practice, etc. This is what it can feel like, this incredibly powerful sun arising in your mind. And because it's so beautiful, because it is so powerful, it draws your attention in. And you cannot avoid anymore being absolutely focused because it is so beautiful. This is how samadhi happens. This is why the mind becomes still. It doesn't want to go anywhere else, right? Now, for the first time in your life, you're starting to feel that you are discovering the meaning of life. This is what everything is about, right? Perfect contentment, absolute happiness. You feel complete inside of you, nothing missing anymore. This is everything you ever searched for in your entire life. This is what you're trying to find at this point. So very, very powerful. And then, once you get that samadhi, once you come out of that samadhi afterwards, that is when you have the opportunity to see things in accordance with reality. That's what comes after that. This is the yathābhūta, jñāna-dassanā. Because why is that? Because after a state of samadhi, your mind is incredibly powerful. There's no hindrances there anymore. The mind is very wieldy, very malleable. You can use it for almost anything you want. And it has the ability to penetrate to the truth of reality, what reality actually is all about. Okay, so there you are. This is the Bodhicitta Sutta. Very, very exciting. And if you didn't find it very, very exciting, then you can ask questions about that later on. But very beautiful sutta, in my opinion. And I will stop there. Let's have a short break, and let's come back again at 11 o'clock.